From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, filling in for Terry Gross. The HBO series The Sopranos has been nominated for 16 Emmy Awards, including Best Dramatic Series. Unlike The Godfather or Goodfellas, it captures the day-to-day life of a modern mob family in New Jersey. On today's Fresh Air, we feature a panel discussion with series creator David Chase and his writers talking about The Sopranos at a recent Writers Guild conference. Also, music critic Ken Tucker reviews the latest from George Jones, who almost died earlier this year in a car crash. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Authorities in Atlanta are searching for a man who allegedly killed 12 people. Nine of the victims were killed in shootings at two stock trading firms this afternoon. Police believe the other three victims are the alleged gunman's family members. Joshua Leves of member station WABE reports from Atlanta.
Authorities say Mark Oren Barton, a 44-year-old chemist who recently took up stock trading, walked into a day trading firm at about 3 o'clock today in northern Atlanta. They say he shot at several people and then walked across the street to another office complex and shot people in another day trading business. Nine people died and at least 12 others were injured. Police then determined that three other people were killed today. They believe they were Barton's family members, allegedly shot before he came to the office complexes. About 100 police are searching the two office buildings, and scores of others are looking for him near his home. Barton's photograph has been released, and authorities have asked anyone who sees him to call them. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Leves in Atlanta.
The Senate has rejected the remaining rivals to the Republicans' $792 billion tax cut. Republicans and Democratic moderates withdrew their proposal for a more modest $500 billion tax cut when it became clear that there wasn't enough support for it. Earlier, senators voted down an amendment by Texas Republican Phil Graham that would have offered a 10% across-the-board tax cut. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright spent the day in Kosovo, where she appealed for unity between Serbs and Albanians. Albright congratulated the UN and the NATO peacekeeping force, KFOR, for their efforts to rebuild Kosovo. NPR's Jennifer Glass reports from Pristina.
Madeleine Albright was cheered by thousands of Kosovo Albanians in the capital, Pristina, as she told the crowd that it is a time of hope and opportunity in Kosovo. But she warned them against replacing the tyranny of the Serb regime is one that oppresses Serbs, as Albanians were once discriminated against here. She said the world community would stop supporting Kosovo if its people allowed retaliation to color their actions. Since the war ended last month, there have been numerous revenge attacks by ethnic Albanians on Serbs. Last week, 14 Serb farmers were murdered in their fields. Albright condemns the killings and asked the people of Kosovo to embrace a basic principle of democracy, where people are not judged on their religious or ethnic background, but on their actions. Jennifer Glass, NPR News, Pristina.
A federal judge in Little Rock, Arkansas, has ordered President Clinton to pay a sanction of more than $90,000 for giving false testimony to the lawyers for Paula Jones. Most of the money will go to Jones and her lawyers to cover expenses caused by the president's testimony denying that he had a sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky. The Dow lost 181 points today. This is NPR News. The Food and Drug Administration has approved a new morning-after contraceptive treatment. The treatment, which will be available by prescription through Planned Parenthood, will be marketed under the name Plan B. An FDA spokeswoman said the treatment appears to be as effective as the current morning-after contraceptive, but has less severe side effects. Studies have shown that the treatment reduces the chance of pregnancy from one act of unprotected sex from 8% to 1%. A judge in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, denied bail today to three people charged with smuggling weapons to Ireland. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports from Miami.
The three suspects, two men and a woman, were arrested in the Fort Lauderdale area on Monday. The FBI is accusing the three, along with three other people arrested in Ireland and one in Philadelphia, of conspiracy to mail packages containing firearms and ammunition to alleged terrorists in Northern Ireland. An FBI affidavit says the weapons were concealed in boxes with children's toys, a VCR, and baby clothes. Some of the packages mailed from the Philadelphia area were intercepted by postal authorities in New York. The group is suspected of buying at least 50 guns in Florida and ordering almost 36 more for shipment to a renegade faction of the Irish Republican Army. The main body of the IRA is honoring a ceasefire amid peace talks with the British and Irish governments. Cheryl Duvall, NPR News, Miami.
The nation's economic growth slowed in the second quarter as consumers got more cautious about spending. The Commerce Department said the gross domestic product grew by 2.3% from April through June, down from 4.3% in the first quarter. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. I'm a huge fan of the HBO series The Sopranos, and I'm not alone. The show just copped 16 Emmy nominations, and you can see it in reruns on HBO this summer till a new batch of shows arrives in January. The Sopranos is about a New Jersey mob boss named Tony Soprano, played by James Gandolfini. Tony's been under a lot of stress. Things are not going smoothly at home or at work. And one of the few things that comforts him is a family of wild ducks who have taken up residence in his swimming pool. When they fly off, he suffers an anxiety attack and passes out. At the urging of his doctor, Tony decides, reluctantly, to go into therapy. Here's a scene from the pilot in which Gandolfini, as Tony, is in the office of his new therapist, played by Lorraine Bracco.
Anxiety attacks are legitimate psychiatric emergencies. Suppose you were driving and you passed out.
Let me tell you something. Nowadays, everybody's got to go to shrinks and counselors and go on Sally, Jesse, Raphael and talk about their problems. Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type? That was an American. He wasn't in touch with his feelings. He just did what he had to do. See, what they didn't know was once they got Gary Cooper in touch with his feelings, that they wouldn't be able to shut him up. And then it's dysfunction this, and dysfunction that, and dysfunction my fungal.
You have strong feelings about this.
Let me tell you something. I had a semester and a half of college, so I understand Freud. I understand therapy as a concept. But in my world, it does not go down. Could I be happier? Yeah. Who couldn't?
Do you feel depressed? Do you feel depressed?
Since the ducks left, I guess.
Today we're going to hear a panel discussion featuring the creator and writers of The Sopranos. It was taped at a conference held by the Writers Guild Foundation in Los Angeles earlier this summer. The moderator is Susan Bullington Katz, who contributes to the Guild's magazine, Written By. The participants are the show's creator, David Chase, whose previous credits include Northern Exposure and The Rockford Files, and three of the show's writers, Frank Renzulli, Robin Green, and Mitchell Burgess. Chase told the conference audience about the show's bumpy beginnings. He was working with the Brillstein Gray Agency, which was sending a couple of his scripts around Hollywood. Chase had a development deal with Fox that hadn't amounted to anything, but they got first look at The Sopranos pilot script. And Katz asked Chase what reaction he got from the network executives.
I turned the script in, and I was waiting for a response, and a week went by, and then 2 weeks went by. And about through the third week, one of the executives called me up and said, "Listen, I just wanted to tell you how great your script is." I said, "Oh, thanks." He said, "Oh, it's fantastic, and it's just marvelous." And I said, "Well, good. When are we going to get started?" I mean, this is how naive I was. She said, "Oh, well, no. There's a lot's going to happen from here on in." She said, first of all, we have to decide, do we want to do a family drama?" I said, "Well, yeah, but you commissioned it. Why don't you want to do a family drama?" "Well, we have a lot of shows, and there's a lot of things to think about." And she said, "So it's going to get kind of dicey from here on, but I just wanted to call you and tell you on a human level that I really thought the script was great." That was that.
And then what happened with it? It made another little journey before it got to HBO.
Yeah, Brillstein Gray, they sent it almost to all the networks. And, it was roundly passed on. and it was just languishing there. And I had said originally, right after the Fox thing, I had said, well, can't we go to HBO? And I don't remember the reasons why they said no. I think they thought, well, there wouldn't be enough money there to do the show well. But Brillstein, you know, Brad had a big relationship with HBO, and so at some point, and my deal was just about to expire, and they said, gee, this is terrible. The guy wrote two pilots, nothing happened. Let's take this over to HBO. And so we went there, and it just, you know, the fat out of the fire, or whatever you call it.
Great. Is it really true that somebody said along the way, does he have to be in therapy?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So then what, with HBO, what did they, what'd they say?
That was really interesting. They asked all the right questions, and it's funny because it wasn't until I was into the process with them that I began to see that I realized the difference. And what happened was you know, cut forward ahead to like about 3 months from that first meeting, we were about to get started shooting and we had budget problems. And we had a scene, this Tony has a boat, like as a, you know, cabin cruiser at the Jersey Shore. And there had been a scene that was in an apartment, which I just changed to put on this boat. He's there with his mistress. And so we were having these budget problems, and I had a conversation with Chris Albrecht, and he says, I don't know, you know, he says, look, you gotta make some cuts here. I don't, you know, we're over, and now there's, he said, we bought this mob show, and now there's boats and waterfalls. He said, well, I don't understand what this boat thing is. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, so I hung up the phone and I realized, you know, if that had been a network, they would have been saying to me, shouldn't the boat be in Cannes? And shouldn't we actually play this whole thing in Vegas? And shouldn't we be on a penthouse? He was saying there was too much glitz. And I thought, whoa. It was like through the looking glass, you know. I sort of saw what he was saying. And I thought, he doesn't want this to be glitzy. And the boat wasn't glitzy. It was a terrible old boat. But but he really didn't want that. So we got along well.
Now, I want to ask you, what was it that you had been, Robin and Mitchell had been writing together for a long time before this. What was it that attracted you two to the script or the show?
Well, we read the pilot when it was first written, I think, and the other pilot, which is also very good.
Yeah, no, I mean, Dave's a great writer, and we stuff pops
and off the page. David, and I've always had an affinity for this kind of mob stuff, grew up in Providence, and I just loved it. I just thought it was great.
I read the pilot, and I dog-eared the pages, and I called David up. I'd say, boy, this is a great one. I mean, it just really was fun stuff, and better than fun. It was something there. It was a real piece of meat there to chew on.
And
we were really happy to...
We saw David had a screening of this, and so he showed the pilot at Sony, and so... You know, we all went and saw it in a movie theater kind of thing on a big screen. And it was just, it was even
how people were howling. It was just great.
It was great. Mm-hmm.
And how about you, Frank?
Yes.
What was it that that drew you into it? And was there anything in specific?
Besides poverty? Well, it's ironic. She said she had an affinity for this type of material, whereas I had more of an aversion to it coming from kind of this world. And when I met David the first time, I think the first question I had after reading and seeing, knowing it so personally as I do, I said, all right, David, come clean. What's with this chase? I knew there was an Italian-American, and it was just so real. I mean, real to the point where it was like, so, and David actually educated me along the way. My frustration with a lot of mob stuff was my aversion wasn't to the Italian part of it, but rather the bad writing part of it, you know? And there's a difference between a Tony Soprano and a guy who says, hey, Joey, get the car, you know? and when you see this over and over again, hey, mama, you know, you just create, it's an aversion. What else, I don't know what else you could call it, to that material. And this was so much more different than anything like that. I mean, it started with the premise of when I read and, like I said, saw it, human, you know, American, suburban, blah, 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 blah. And down the line, Italian-American. It was the commonality, and it showed Italian-Americans in this world and these families as very real people that I could relate to not just because of the Italian stuff, but because I have a mother. I believe it or not, you know? And I have a brother, I have a sister, I have all these things, and even a therapist, you know? So, might throw you, but anyway, yeah. So, I mean, I like everyone else, you know, that read and saw the pilot, I was blown away, and I just completely, and for the very reasons that I loved Godfather 1 and 2, Mean Streets, which, you know, for neighborhood guys was wow, you know, at that time. You know, for the very same reasons, I was attracted to this. I didn't really know what it was specifically, but at some point I intellectualized it, as I just did. But I was drawn to the honesty.
So did you find out the story behind the name Chase?
Yes, I did. And it's a beautiful Italian-American name, which I would wish he would adopt again. Di Cesare, am I correct?
That's correct.
Di Cesare. And that's of Caesar. So Caesar is a indication there.
Famous guy.
famous Italian guy.
They said, oh my God, what a great name, of Caesar.
I said,
of Caesar. I said, yeah. We were probably slaves.
That's right.
We're of Caesar. We're, you know.
Well, I did wonder, and I wondered. Well, when I, what's a nice guy like Chase knowing all about his mafia stuff? But in the meantime, do you have to speak mafia to write for this show?
It helps. I mean, whatever that means, speaks mafia, it helps.
Uh-huh.
But I, in a way, don't know what that means. I mean, there's a lot of whack and all that stuff. I mean, we all know that, you know. I guess what you have to be able to do is bust people's balls. Like, in scenes, there's always antagonism going on. Even the tender moments are antagonistic and sarcastic. And you have to have I think that's one of the keys. You have to have a feel for that.
Yeah. That is really true. Every scene, there is that kind of tension going on. Even in one person, even if it's a solo scene, we know the pulls on that character.
Well, they're always attacking each other, even just little love taps, you know. But it's not, no one ever says, I love you. Wow, this was a great job you did. So people just, you know, they say something like that, but it comes out as half an insult, you know.
What are some of the things they say instead of I love you?
Jeez, I don't know. What do they say instead of I love you? What do they say instead of I love you?
Instead of I love you, I don't know. Jeez, you take a good slap. for a fat broad, you don't sweat too much. I don't know. I really don't know on the spot.
We're listening to a panel discussion with the creator and writers of the HBO series The Sopranos. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with the creator and writers of the HBO drama series The Sopranos, here's moderator Susan Bullington Katz.
One of the hallmarks of this show also is that there's a lot that's left out. There are blanks that it's as if you trust the viewer to get it. You know, I'm still waiting to find out about Carmela's stock that just split. But that kind of thing, you know, we're sort of waiting. Or we'll find in a future episode, there'll be mention of something that was started in episode 3, and we don't know exactly what happened in between, but now we can fill it in with our own imaginations.
That's as we forget.
Oh.
Honestly, we have all these stories, and we have these intentions, and then we go, holy Jesus, remember we were going to do this thing in episode 2? We don't even know what happened to the guy, you know?
That's hysterical. That's hysterical. So do your characters surprise you now?
Yeah.
How so?
Well, how so? This is the best group of actors I've ever worked with. And the reason, if you feel the writing is good, part of the a lot of the reason for that is because these actors have invested so much in it and bring so much to it that it just keeps getting bigger and better and more rich. And
whoa, wait a minute.
What?
The writing is good.
And they say that. The actors say this is the best. This is great writing. The actors all. We have a reading before a show at lunch, and they always come in, and they're laughing, and they love the scripts. And what about the...
And the crew.
The crew would pass the scripts around.
Without the actors.
Without the actors.
Yeah, I didn't mean to demean the writing of the show. why do they surprise us and how? I think maybe it's because, in a way, this has never been done before, so... The fact that these people are gangsters, in a way, no matter what they do, is kind of like, what are they doing that? I mean, I didn't realize they had peanut butter and jelly or something. You know what I mean? It's like, because you're used to seeing, it's all about fighting. It's about fighting, what is it, 70 years now of film, you know, renditions of these people. And so I think that's the reason why.
Huh. Also, I think that, for me, watching all these movies that we talked about, the type of movies, the gangster genre and everything, you know, the guy who said, you know, you say, Joey, get the car. You know, and Joey goes to get the car. On this show, we get to find out who Joey is. You know, we get to go with them to the car and then go home with them sometimes, you know? It's not just Joey. The ancillary characters are real people. They have a full life.
And the writing is fantastic.
No, but I really believe, our characters are real to me. I mean, I believe in Silvio Dante and Paulie Walnuts and Pussy. I mean, these guys are real people to me, and that makes it easier and funner to do, really.
I'm curious because these guys make reference all the time to The Godfather or other movies and shows that they've seen. It's real self-referential about the media. What kind of mail do you get? Do you have any idea that some of the guys, like the guys you're writing about, are watching your show?
I have some idea. The thing about it is, you never can tell. People say, oh, you know, we're okay. I got phone calls. We're okay here in Brooklyn, you know. Now, I don't know. Who knows?
Really?
Yeah.
What does that mean exactly, we're okay?
We're okay. It means we're okay in Brooklyn. It means they saw it. We're okay.
No one's going to bother you.
No one's going to bother you. You know, and this person that was talking does have some... Or says he has some connections to the real world there, but who knows if that's true or who he's talking to? It could be some, you know, who really knows? But some people we know have like family. They're married into it and stuff like that. And they've said that Sopranos is in the social club, the poster and all that stuff, and they really like it.
Oh yeah.
Huh. But I don't know. That's for every crew. I have no idea.
Mitchell, you're from Iowa. Mm-hmm. What's the hardest part for you about writing the show?
Trying to get those cows into every episode. Trying to find a way to work them in.
I don't know what the hardest part to write about it, but this, when we went out to New York, I've been to Manhattan once or twice, and David insists we shoot in New Jersey, and our studio is in Queens, and I looked out, and there's the subway running over, and there's this brick building, and I couldn't understand why we weren't just shooting in Queens, and then finally, after going to New Jersey enough, there's a real particular, and I finally thought I'd become like a Sopranoite. You know, I figured out what New Jersey was, and I could tell when we went through the tunnel, there was New Jersey, and what this town looked like, and Kearny, and West Orange, and Elizabeth, and I know them all now. I mean, we have a map up, and I can't wait to go back and eat some more Brujol.
Brujol.
So, I suppose being like an Easterner, that kind of ball breaking. Eastern. That didn't cross the Mississippi ball breaking very much, so in Iowa. But I'm working on it. I'm working on my ball breaking.
That's the hardest part. And how about for you, Robin? What are the things that
she's a ball buster. I've known it for a long time. No problem.
I want to ask you also about the therapy aspect of the show. Because we do see Tony in therapy sessions, sometimes in odd locations having therapy sessions. You hear from somebody in Brooklyn letting you know that you're okay. How about the therapy contingent out there watching it?
The therapists really like it. In fact, we got an award from them. They like it for the most part. They really enjoy it. In fact, I had a call from a guy who actually told me some interesting things about our characters and stuff in a way that I didn't know about. He described them as elixithymics. It means someone who has to keep moving, who has to keep moving forward, otherwise they're going to stop and think and reflect on the universe, and then it'll all come crushing in on them. So there's this whole need for action, gambling, shooting, screwing, taking drugs. That's elixithymia. So I thought that was pretty interesting. But they seem to say that it's a pretty good rendition of psychotherapy. I think it's accurate in the sense that nothing changes because of it.
Creator David Chase and the writers from the HBO series The Sopranos. Here's another scene. Tony, his wife, and kids are eating takeout Chinese after the FBI has searched their home. One of the agents particularly riled Tony.
What was his last name? Rizzo, what?
Grasso.
Grasso. You think it's a coincidence they sent him? If he wasn't Italian, he'd be back at the office sweeping up. The stupid jerk. They probably frisk him every night before he goes home.
Why?
Why? Because he has a vowel at the end of his name. That's why, Grasso. I mean, what you think? He's going to make it to the top by arresting his own people?
Pass the mushroom.
He'll see. He'll learn.
We have a vow.
I've been right, and you'll be proud of it. Jesus Christ, you think there never was a Michelangelo, the way they treat people.
Did you know that an Italian invented the telephone?
Alexander Graham Bell was Italian.
You see what I'm talking? Antonio Meucci invented the telephone, and he got robbed. Everybody knows that.
Who invented the mafia?
What?
La Cosa Nostra, who invented that?
Who cares?
Wasn't it Salvatore Lucana, better known as Charlie Lucky Luciano, who organized the five families? Lucchese, Gambino, Bonanno, Profaci.
Is there something you want to say to me?
I just like history, like you, Dad.
Can you just shut the f*** up about it?
Hey.
Hey.
We'll hear more from the folks who create The Sopranos in the second half of our show. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Volare. Oh,
canta. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword, BN. And from Time Magazine, this week remembering JFK Jr. and his family's history of public service. Who will continue the legacy? Additional support from Vizix Laser Vision Correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. And from World Wildlife Fund, working in more than 100 countries around the world to leave our children a living planet. On the web, worldwildlife.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the search for Livia, the ultimate Italian mother. David Chase talks about how he came up with Nancy Marchand to play the mother of the mob boss in his series The Sopranos. And music critic Ken Tucker reviews the latest CD by country legend George Jones. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today we're listening to a panel discussion with the creator and writers of the hit HBO series The Sopranos. It was taped last month at a conference held by the Writers Guild Foundation in L.A. We'll hear from the show's creator, writer and producer, David Chase, and writers Robin Green, Mitchell Burgess, and Frank Renzulli. The moderator is Susan Bullington Katz.
There are some questions from the audience that I'd like to ask now. Okay, and I'm going to let you all jump in, whoever wants. What kind of research did you do into the mafia structure?
That's a good question. I've been interested in this since I was a kid, so I've read a lot about it in newspapers. And, you know, being from New Jersey, there was a lot of stuff like that. And so it's just accumulated over a lifetime. The movies have helped. You know, obviously, The Godfather was a big thing. It showed you something which you hadn't really seen before. And in hindsight, we can go back and say, well, that doesn't really seem that realistic. But at that time, it seemed very realistic. And it was a look at something we really hadn't seen. We've talked to some people in law enforcement and also people who were in the life, you know, who said they were in the life.
Here's a question that's sort of the flip side of that, which says, notwithstanding the superb writing, directing, acting, producing, how do you answer the Italian-American critics that say you perpetuate a damaging stereotype?
Yeah, David.
Oh, goody. How do I answer it? Well, I think that's just such a bunch of hypocrisy that I can't believe it. I also think that it trivializes the whole idea of civil rights and racial discrimination. The Italians have really done very well in this country, and we're a secure group of Americans. And to keep flogging this thing is just wheel spinning. I don't think it has any value. I don't think there's any, especially since if you pick up a newspaper and you see a story about organized crime, those names are Italian. I didn't make that up. Martin Scorsese didn't make that up. Francis Coppola didn't make that up. That's just the way it is. And they should, if they're really concerned about it, the image of gangsters and Italians, they should really be organizing some sort of grassroots neighborhood thing to get rid of those people and not to have, and to instruct their youth and their children that gangsterism is wrong. But don't take it up with us. We have, you know, I answer it.
Well, I think the problem also is that now it's out there and it's never going away. They're virtually not there now. You know, you don't need a grassroots, it's called the RICO Act, that is pretty much taken a lot of them out of the game. But, you know, it's now become a favorite antagonist or anti-hero or, you know, of Americana. You know, and like David, you know, I am from that side of it. I am one of those people who gets insulted occasionally or a lot by a lot of things that are insulting to Italian Americans, I feel. I don't think this is one of them. I think that what's missing is the contrast, the balance, and you go down that whole thing. You know, give us more Italian judges out of that. By getting rid of these Italian gangsters, that so then you'll have no Italians on television. You know, you'll have nothing. You know, you'll have polenta is what you'll have.
the other aspect of it is that I cannot help but forget that the Italian Anti-Defamation Movement was started by Joe Colombo, the head of the Colombo family. And I just act from that premise, you know.
Great, great. Next season, do you expect pressure from within, meaning HBO, or without, meaning the media, over the violence?
I don't know. Not from HBO, I don't think.
I read something about is it okay to give away? I mean, for some people, is there anybody here who hasn't seen all the episodes this year? Oh, there are a few. Is it okay if I mention what happens in a later episode? Okay. Because I want to ask you,
a crying game?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, there's a point where Tony, it's on the Looking at Colleges trip episode, where he doesn't just kill somebody from a far distance with a gun. He actually does it by hand, by strangling the guy. And it looks on his face like there is a certain pleasure in that. And when you talk about the meaning of that, because I think if we understand the meaning of violent acts, I think it goes a long way toward understanding the bigger question. what part violence plays?
Well, realistically, we just didn't think you'd have a gun up there on that college trip, for one thing. Since you'd come by airplane and all that, you just couldn't get, you know. But we also felt it was important that he do it, that he'd be very hands-on about it. Because the show was about the fact that he was wedded to a code and that he would act on that code, which he believes is a soldier's code, a warrior's code. That's what he believes about it, and that he would act on it and he would make it very personal, and he would do it a code that which even he knows is kind of bankrupt, but it's the code he's allegedly he took an oath, and he's got to do it. And so it just felt very important that he do this personally, just personally confront this guy and be able to say the things to him that he said before he killed him.
Somebody in the audience wants to know specifically more about the mother and says, what's the deal with Tony's mom? Is she crazy, evil, or both? Are we ever going to find out what really makes her tick, or would that kill the mystique of the character?
She's Italian, she said. Yeah, that's a lot of it.
Southern Italian.
Southern Italian.
Well, this is, it's based on perhaps David's mother. Maybe you could answer that.
Well.
Or maybe his wife could answer.
In the sort of the main dynamic of her is based on my mother. The character initially said a lot of things my mother said. But my mother, you know, never tried to have me killed, obviously. It was nothing like that. Although, if it had happened, she would have said, well, he must have been doing something wrong. Yeah. I told him. You know. So, the mother is an interesting character. She's very passive aggressive, is really what it is. It's passive aggressivity, whatever you want to call it, like to the nth degree. And she's like the baby of the family. She's like the biggest Tony. She is a baby. And she, her moods and her thoughts and her phobias just count for everything to her. And what goes on in her head is much more important than what goes on in the outside world. So. I don't know, did I answer your question? Mm-hmm. Well, would we ever know what really is making her tick? No. No, because I don't think that happens in real life. You know, people go to their graves and they're still mysteries. You know? It seems to me, but no, we'll never find out. Because I don't know what makes her tick.
That's David Chase, creator of the HBO series The Sopranos, talking about the show's unrelenting matriarch, played by Nancy Marchand. In this scene, Tony's visiting her. She's just had a minor car accident, and he's trying to convince her to move to a very nice residential facility. But she won't have it. Instead, she offers stuff of hers before she dies, the lamps, the Barca lounger. But she slips in that she's given away her really valuable jewelry to a cousin.
You listen to me now. Before you do any more serious damage to yourself or your grandchildren's inheritance, you're going to stop living alone right now.
I'm not going to that nursing home.
Green Grove is a retirement community, and it's more like a hotel at Captain Teeb's.
Who's he?
Captain owns luxury hotels or something, I don't know. That's not the point. The point is, I talked to Mrs. DiCaprio over there, and she says she's got a corner suite available with a woods view. It's available now, but it's gonna go fast.
Of course it's available. Somebody died.
Oh, Ma, you gotta stop. You gotta stop with this black poison cloud all the time, because I can't take it anymore.
Oh, poor you.
You know, I got problems at work. I got problems at home. I got a friend who's been diagnosed with cancer. Most parents would be grateful if their yuppie children put as much thought into this as I did.
I'm not going to that place.
Then I will go to court and I will get a durable power of attorney over you and I will place you there.
Then kill me now. Go on, go. Go into the ham. And take the carving knife and stab me here. Here. Now, please. It would hurt me less than what you just said.
You know, I know seniors that are inspired.
More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to a panel discussion with the writers of the HBO drama series The Sopranos about a modern-day New Jersey mafia family. Here's moderator Susan Bullington Katz.
I want to know just who was it who named the daughter Meadow? Anthony Jr. fits, and the name Meadow, I think, tells us maybe, I don't know, I'm reading into it, but I think it maybe tells us a little bit about Carmela and Tony at the time she was born.
Yeah, I named her Meadow. You know, to a certain extent, Carmela and Tony are, even though they live this sort of very, in a way, segregated life, mob life, they are products of the 70s. And we've done that as a rule. All the kids in that town, we always give them like these Hunter Scangarello and Meadow Soprano. And and then recently Robin brought in a thing from Providence was obituaries. And it said, you know, somebody, Mary Angela DiStefano had died. And it said, survived by grandchildren, Jason.
Ashley.
Ashley. and, you know. Meadow.
It's true.
Very interesting.
It's just part of the assimilation process, you know.
I think that's true for everyone's culture. I mean, yeah, when was the last time you ran into an Ishka Bibble? You know.
Good point. This is for David Chase, and I bet the rest of you have comments on this too. The casting of Nancy Marchand, Edie Falco, and Lorraine Bracco is inspired. How did they fit your original conception of the characters? P.S. Your women are terrific.
Thank you. How do they fit my original? I mean, did they come close to the original? Yeah, I guess they do. But at the same time, they bring so much of themselves that it's not. It's a really hard thing. I mean, I guess they do, but they're not. The three of them are just amazing actresses. And Lorraine was not my conception of the psychiatrist originally. Actually, Lorraine is very psychologically astute, and she's been in therapy a lot. But but she's not someone, if you were to meet her, or if you've seen her past roles, you know, she's not someone who would strike you as a therapist. And yet, that's what she wanted to do. That's the reason she wanted to do it, was to do something different. And yet, so instead of, because, you know, I think very often psychiatrists are boring on screen. And I think the reason, if she's not, I think the reason she isn't is because there's something going on underneath her, which is that there is that Lorraine that's so all tamped down to play this role. You know.
Yeah.
What about Nancy? I mean, just
Nancy.
The search for that mother.
Nancy, the search for the mother went on. It was we had a lot of trouble. I mean, Miranda Heller is from HBO. She remembers this, I'm sure. It was people came in and just couldn't deliver. On that,
it's a hard thing to get because it's so complicated.
That thing as written, and people were over the top, and they, you know, a lot of their Italian mama thing, and it was shrill and crazy, and you begin to think this isn't going to work. There's something wrong with this, with the writing. That's what you always think. We just had an example of this recently. We think, you know what, this part, this character sucks. It's not working. We got to change it all. And then an actor comes in, and he goes boom, and it's like, wow. It's just a question of getting. It just takes time. And so Nancy was one of the last, obviously not one of the last because she got the job, but I was really scared. And then she came in and it was just there, not to do anything, not to say anything, no guidance, no nothing.
There's a tremendous sense of relief when that happened.
Tremendous sense of relief. And she just understood it. Obviously she understood this person, you know.
Because you hear this stuff read over and over, your lines in casting, and if the actor's not doing what you imagine, it makes the writing look bad.
It makes you doubt what you're doing. You think maybe we should fix this, you know, and maybe we should.
With her passive aggression, is it hard? Is she one of the harder characters to write for?
Not for me.
Not for me.
I was going to say that when I first saw the pilot and all that. I mean, she made me so tense, and I was saying, why is this woman making me tense? Pretty obvious, you know. The phone rang, my mom, and I think that she in many ways embodies so many of our mothers, especially at that point in their life. I mean, my mother is about almost 80. I mean, you know, and I don't know if it's the age, the ethnicity, the motherhood, I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, I want to choke the cat, you know. And she does, and she, even though this is an actress and I know I'm watching a scene, it actually triggers that. It's like a Pavlovian response, you know.
The show, there's a lot of relentless people in the show, and she is the most relentless. I mean, even in that situation with wise guys and people who kill people, she just doesn't stop.
Yeah, never. You know what? When I was talking about the laughter before, it's hysteria. That's what I was trying to say about it. These people are hysterics. Almost all of them are
hysterical. Yeah, they're all out of control.
And the thing we laugh at when we talk about our own tales and our own mothers, it's really so painful. I mean, the things that we're laughing about.
It happens during some of this violent stuff too. You're liking these people who are violent. You're laughing at, you know, somebody getting a poison ivy attack while he's shooting somebody. You're not supposed to be laughing, but you're laughing.
Because in life, people don't die too funny. You know, I mean, you know, as we know, you know.
I
don't think the people should die funny. Honestly.
No, they don't die funny. No, it's just the circumstances around it. There's someone that can be complaining about the poison ivy at that moment. And then make it the guy's fault on the ground in some way, you know.
I think that's one of the, you bring up a good point. It's just not anything to do with anything. I think that's one of the salient, or whatever, one of the big features of the show is that every character, this is where Olivia really said, every character is always blaming other people for their problems. No one takes responsibility for anything. They're all, like the guy who got the poison, he ran into the poison ivy, and he got mad at the guy who was supposed to kill him. You know, that's what started him shooting. And they always are saying, it's your fault, it's your fault, it's your fault. That's sort of what it's about, I guess.
Well, doesn't that provide a little bit of tension then when Tony's in therapy and part of the goal of therapy is to accept responsibility for things? What is that going to do to Tony Soprano?
Were you ever in therapy?
Oh, yeah.
What did it do for you?
Well, I killed probably fewer people with guns since then, but it just changed it to worse.
Did it really change your life in any way?
Did it change my life? Did it change my life?
I guess that answers that.
It probably helped make it easier to do the things I was going to do anyway.
Well, that's what's happening with Tony.
Well, you know. you know what therapy did for me? Therapy made it, gave me the ability to spot other people who have been in therapy. I don't know how else to say it.
Actually, I think that therapy as it's practiced today, or maybe always, or in this country, is the ultimate place of non-accountability. There's the therapist, you're the patient, whatever you did is okay. Think about where you came from. If you'd had a father like, if someone else had a father like that, they'd be throwing their kid down the stairs. I know it wasn't a great thing, but it's all about you. It's all exculpatory, and it's always about, and they never take a moral position. They can't, I guess, but it is frustrating. And I don't think there's any accountability having to do with anything in therapy. Or it's not, at least it's not direct, you know? I don't know.
Huh.
I mean, you know, you guys say, well, don't you think that was terrible? Well, do you want me to say it was terrible? Do you want me to?
Interesting. Does it help if your writers have been through that process?
Yeah.
How so?
I really can't say, except we did have some writers who hadn't been, and there was something...
Something missing.
We said, go out, have some life trauma. Come back when you're twitching.
Writers from the hit HBO series The Sopranos, Frank Renzulli, Robin Green, and Mitchell Burgess, and the show's creator, David Chase. They appeared at the Writers Guild Foundation conference held last month in L.A. The panel was moderated by Susan Bullington Katz. We'd like to thank all the panelists, the Writers Guild Foundation, Dennis Davidson Associates, and Sound Images, who recorded the proceedings. Tapes of this and all the sessions from the conference are available through the conference's website, www.wordsintopictures.org. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the latest from George Jones. This is Fresh Air. Country music legend George Jones almost died in a car accident on March 6th. The 67-year-old singer suffered a collapsed lung, a lacerated liver, and developed pneumonia. Jones has recovered and is out and about to enjoy the praise being heaped on the new CD recorded shortly before his accident. It's called Cold Hard Truth. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
You don't know who I am, but I know all about you. I've come to talk to you tonight about the things I've seen. Come to set the record straight. I've come to shine the light on you. Let me introduce myself. I am the cold hard truth.
The cold, hard truth about George Jones's new collection is that it's very good indeed, if not quite the masterpiece that it's being hailed as by critics who listen to country music out of duty or when it makes news, as this one did in the wake of Jones's car crash. Cold, Hard Truth is Jones's first release for Asylum Records. He spent the past decade on MCA, recording uneven, often sterile CDs that nonetheless sometimes contained a few striking, powerful performances, in which his high-pitched Texas twang pierced the mediocrity of the arrangement or the lyric. I would recommend 1992's Walls Can Fall as Jones's best MCA work. But Cold Hard Truth is a great way for critics and lapsed fans to reacquaint themselves with Jones, since producer Keith Stegall surrounds the singer with the sort of stripped-down accompaniment that showcases his undiminished mastery of phrasing, as on a song called This Wanting You.
I almost wish that I could lose my mind sometime. Then maybe I'd be free of memories you left behind. With every single thought I hate to face the truth. It's never ending, always there, this wanting you.
This is a bad time commercially for country music senior citizens like Jones. Country radio, a generally foul, shallow, trend-following community, promotes young, pretty faces that chirp insipidly happy songs. So it's great that the first single from the album, a tune called Choices, is actually being played and is crawling up the charts as surely as Jones used to crawl the barroom floors he implicitly acknowledges here.
I've had choices since the day that I was born. There were voices that told me right from wrong. If I had listened, no, I wouldn't be here today, living and dying with the choices I've made. I was tempted.
Cold Hard Truth contains a mere 10 songs, skimpy for a CD, but completely standard in the old days of country music released on vinyl. More problematic is the fact that this mere 10 includes a couple of clunkers, like the falsely jaunty You Never Know Just How Good You've Got It. Jones, at his finest, a profound artist of unhappiness, has always been a sucker for cheap novelty songs. He thinks they show a range his truest fans know he doesn't need to demonstrate. But this new CD is still a bargain, if only because it's one of the few new releases to offer pure hardcore country. Music that makes no accommodation to rock and roll and is unafraid to be maudlin or weepy.
If you think you can depend on me, you're right, you can. If you think that I'm in love with you, you're right, I am. but nothing lasts forever. All good things must end, and it's only a matter of time. Day after forever, I'm out that door, one way or the other, to return nevermore. Don't count on me, baby, for I will be gone day after forever, on your own, your own.
George Jones carries a heavy burden. He's one of the last of a vanishing breed. He's had to fight alcoholism. The law found a half-empty vodka bottle rolling around in that car he smashed in March. And he's had to measure himself against the myth he created, first as a solo singer, and then as the difficult, often abusive husband he played in his classic team-ups with Melba Montgomery in the 60s and with real-life wife Tammy Wynette in the 70s. Jones married Nancy Sepulvado, who also now manages him, and he got sober in 1983, only to see his career do a slow fade. Now he's back, and if it took that car crash to get him the publicity that's put him back on the radio, well, a hard luck guy like George ought to know by now, you never know when a blessing in disguise is going to come along.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Roberta Schorock. Bob Purdick was our engineer. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Twisted toward the roof off a grocery store, blew an Idaho potato through the hardwood floor, twirled Granny's apron up around her head, the cat's gone missing and the dog is dead. Well, ain't love a lot like that? Ain't love a lot like that? Unconditional, unpredictable.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture. And from Little Brown & Company, publishers of The Miracle of Castel di Sangro by Joe McGinnis, in hardcover wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're listening to the Tuvan throat singing of Ondar. On the next Fresh Air, Ondar demonstrates his singing. He's featured in the new documentary film, Genghis Blues. Join us for the next Fresh Air.